Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Fiona Narduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and I'm with Lucy Dallas, our arts editor. Hello, Lucy.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. I would like to be distracted with news of your reading.
Well, I can confidently announce that with my I have done some of my lockdown project.
Excellent.
How often do you hear that happen? I certainly didn't do any the first time. And on your prompting, Thea, I have read the first of the Cazalet Chronicles.
Have you finished it?
Yeah, because I read it really fast because
it's hard
really
to stop.
Enjoyed it. It was really hard to stop. Yeah,
she's. It's just the. I think the way that she writes children's dialogue is just something else.
Yeah, this is. I didn't know much about her. Elizabeth Jane Howard. For the must be an absolute tiny number of people who don't know exactly what we're talking about, who are faithful followers. We were wondering what to read during the second lockdown, and Thea recommended that I read the Cazalet Chronicles by
Elizabeth. It's been a project about 3 years in the making.
Yes, and finally I said okay, and I absolutely loved it. Yeah, and the children's, because she has this wonderful, it makes perfect sense that Hilary Mantel thinks she's terrific and, you know, sings her praises and stuff, because she's got this kind of indirect narrative that slips into the head of this person, and as they're thinking about something, then it slips into the head of the next person, and it goes around every character in the book, I think probably you get the thoughts of everyone, don't you?
Yeah, and certainly, and then in the subsequent novels, because it's one of five, different characters obviously kind of come to the fore and others recede as they age or as things happen in their lives. The next one is, have you ordered it yet?
I haven't ordered it yet. I'm going to.
Ration.
But I did also order The Light Years, because that's apparently brilliant, but that's not a Cazalet one, so I will have to get the next one.
My head is still spinning from last week's Books of the Year show. I ended up with so many books to order.
Did you get any of them?
Well, I've sort of lost track of what they are. I've ordered loads, so it'll be a pleasant surprise when they drop through onto the doormat. I'll have forgotten that I ordered them.
I ordered that one to Calais in Ordinary Time because it just sounded terrific. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know I ordered Kiss Myself Goodbye, The Many Lives of Aunt Munka, which was one of yours, I think, by Ferdinand Mount.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's the one I'd like to borrow.
Oh, I thought you had read it. Okay, well, I'm
no,
very
I
much
haven't,
looking forward
no,
to that.
No, I haven't. Afraid not. No, no, no.
And I think I was going to post you one. Was I going to post you Caleb Femi's poetry collection, or was it the second volume of the Cazalet Chronicles? I mean, you couldn't
both.
Really ask for
I'd
two
like,
more
I'd
two
like
more
that.
Different books there. The one set on an estate in South London now, and the other set mostly in a Sussex country home during the Second World War.
I heard Caleb Femi talking on the other day on the radio. Yeah, he just sounded terrific. So thoughtful and sort of reflective and engaged, and yeah, he sounded really terrific. But yeah, they it just struck me with the Hilary Mantel thing, that narrative that drifts around, that's completely convincing. I mean, with when Hilary Mantel does it with Cromwell, it's basically him. You know, it's basically his consciousness that you get most of the time. And one of the brilliant things about this is that it moves around. And as you say, she does the children. She doesn't do it in childish language. The language kind of remains the same, but she gets the thing, but whereby they think about something really serious. And then they think, oh God, I hope it's not custard for tea or whatever it is, you know. Or
yeah, the kind of the simultaneity of thought and the rhythm of it as well.
Yeah, and that some things when you're a child seem incredibly serious, and in fact, you know, an adult may think they weren't, and other things that are incredibly serious you might be able to just sort of dismiss. And she takes everyone seriously as well. Everyone's included, as you say, the children and the servants. I'm pretty sure you even get a bit of the cat's viewpoint at one point.
I think you do, yeah.
I just I thought it was completely engrossing. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Coming up on this week's show, Margaret Drabble will join us to discuss Matthew Beaumont's new book, The Walker, on finding and losing yourself in the modern city, which is reviewed in this week's TLS, giving us in the process one of the most intriguing quotes I've read in quite a while. The most entertaining chapter in this volume, Drabble says, speaks of the magnificence and hideousness of big toes. More on that soon. But first, this year marks the centenary of the poet Paul Celan's birth and the 50th anniversary of his suicide by drowning in Paris. A number of significant English language books have been published to mark the occasion, and here to talk us through them and discuss what they add to our picture of the man generally acknowledged as the most important post-war German language poet is Mark Glanville. Mark, hello, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You have a rather nice story about discovering Paul Celan. He was introduced to you in that way that you sort of can't dismiss, I think, with a sense of heartfelt urgency by a trusted friend who thrust him upon you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was introduced to him at a time when I was sort of rediscovering my Jewishness. I was about to get married. I never really had taken it particularly seriously, and then I got married to this Jewish girl. My Jewish godfather, if there is, can be such a thing, Stanley Moss, who's also a very, very fine poet in his own right and publisher in New York. I went to stay with him while I was actually doing some training as an opera singer, funnily enough, at the time. But Stanley had a formidable collection of poetry, which I used to sort of enjoy looking through. And he used to talk me through some of the stuff as well. And I was particularly drawn to Osip Mandelstam, of course, the great Russian Jewish poet, and Paul Celan. Another was Yehuda Amichai, the Israeli poet, who was a great personal friend also of Stanley Moss's, and in fact, whom I got to know reasonably well over the years. But Paul Celan, of everyone, really just spoke to me the most. And the poem which I'll read actually, in fact, targets that. And Celan, it seems, Celan in fact defined Jewishness in his own terms, and it's included in fact in the poem I'm going to read, as a pneuma, the Greek word for a wind, that it was a breath, it was something that you couldn't capture in the way that you can law, for example, in the Jewish liturgy. He seemed to relate to his Jewishness in a way that I did.
We were going to save the poem for a beautiful treat at the end, but I think now that you've introduced it so eloquently, I think we should have the poem. So if you'd like to tell us about Benedicta and then read it for us.
Yeah. So Benedicta is included in the volume of Memory Rose into Threshold Speech, which is this major collection of the first four of Celan's poetry collections, which has been translated by Pierre Joris. So I'm reading it in English, but it starts actually with a quotation in Yiddish. So it's Suken men aruf gein in Himmel rein und fragen bei Gott zu darf azoi sein. Drink, you did, what came to me from the fathers and from beyond the fathers. Pneuma. Blessed be you from afar, from beyond my extinguished finger. Blessed, you who greeted it, the tenebrae lamp. You who heard it as I closed my eyes, how the voice stopped singing after Es muss azoi sein. You who said in the eyeless, the open fields, the same, the other word, be blessed, drunk, blessed, gebenched.
It always strikes me as such a brave and petrifying thing to do, to publish, as Pierre Joris has, a bilingual edition with the German and the English side by side for the critic to compare. Did you find yourself satisfied? Did you find yourself satisfied with this translation? Was it successful?
I think poetry is just always so incredibly problematic to translate, of all the things one has to translate. It's such a difficult task. And there's an interesting thing about Celan, which is that Celan was a poet who in a funny way, was translating himself all the time. That he wasn't actually content, especially in the later poetry, with the language in which he felt he had to write. He called German, post-Holocaust German, a language gagged with the ashes of burned-out meaning. Wonderful expression. And it was the language of his mother. It literally was his mother's tongue. And it was the only language in which he could express himself, although he had written poems in Romanian. And being based in France, he had considered writing poetry in French. But he said he thought in German and he dreamed in German. He had to write in German. He came up with a German language that he forged for himself using neologisms, many of them out of compound words, something which is quite easy to do in German, where a language full of compound words. He mined dictionaries and geological dictionaries, scientific dictionaries for obscure terminology. He went back to medieval German texts. He had to find his own way of expressing himself through the language of his parents' murderers and his own oppressors.
Which was, of course, really the sort of the struggle of his entire life. He has he describes the German language as a domain, which just seems so pertinent for a person whose life and whose parents and people were displaced, were deported from a land. It's incredibly moving. One of the books that you mention, which is a collection of prose writings. I'm just looking for it now. It plucks as its title a line, which again sort of brings to the fore the struggle that we're talking about here. It's called Microliths, They Are Little Stones. An incredibly moving title to choose for a collection. And this collection brings us insight that we didn't have before, I don't think, or perhaps just supplements it, to how this... How Celan struggled with everything, with his personal life as well as his career, because of course the two things are completely imbricated.
Yeah, I think Microliths is a marvelous book. I think it was originally published in German in 2005, and Pierre Joris has just brought out this very important translation, very successfully translated. There are issues. I didn't really fully answer that question, or barely answered it at all, about which I will come back to about the actual translation of the poetry itself, where there are issues and problems. But partly, I think, just because of the nature of the poetry that he has to translate. And then going back to the poem and the idea of pneuma again, and this breath, there's marvelous stuff. The final paragraphs are in fact. Part of an interview with Yehuda Amichai, only two fragments of which survive. He goes back to this whole idea. I'll see if I can find a reference to it, but he talks about, here we are, I actually got it here. It was a 1969 interview, Kol Israel, with Yehuda Amichai, and Celan says, obviously the Jewish as a thematic aspect, but I believe that the thematic alone does not suffice in defining the Jewish. Jewishness is, to say, a pneumatic matter. So he comes, there he is again referring to this in 1969. He also referred to it in his very important Meridian speech, in which he defined his later poetics in 1960. And then there's wonderful sort of prose poetry included in Microliths as well. Just tremendous stuff. Interestingly, Pierre Joris talks about Celan saying that he could have been another Kafka had he chosen to go down the route of a prose writer. I have to say, I couldn't disagree more. I just do not see Celan as a prose writer at all. And in fact, if you look at the high quality prose that's included in this book, it's very, very poetic. It's poetic prose. His muse was not a prosaic muse. It was a poetic muse. It's a rather strange thing to say.
I'm struck by you saying that, Mark, actually, because as I was reading the piece, you get this very strong sense of someone, as we were saying before, is wrestling with the language. He's wrestling with the German language and with his own poetry, because, as you say, the later style, he's trying to move away from the kind of beauty and lyricism, almost because he thinks that's not possible anymore. But there's never a question of of stopping, is there? It's always a question of, I have to do this. How do I do it?
It's a very interesting observation. And what happens is that in the second half of his poetic life, should we say, it did become an existential struggle for him. You could argue that it was a kind of I think, as I say in the piece, there's an epistemological aspect to the earlier work. It's a search for reality, an attempt to make sense of it. And this wonderful phrase that he comes up with, Wirklichkeitswund und Wirklichkeitssuchend. I was wounded by reality and searching for reality. But when it comes to the second part of his career, it becomes an existential endeavor. But he calls it an eye clarifying itself in the process of writing. That's what poetry became to him. So that in order to be able to cope at all, he just simply had to write. And it was all about that. It was all about the necessity to write in order to simply to be able to exist at all.
And this period of transition from one type of poetry to another, are we talking about a transition, a gradual transition, or are there a sort of a series of epiphanies of chapters in that movement?
Well, difficult one to be precise about. I mean, there's something that I actually quote in the review of the 1967 collection Atemwende, which is the breath turn, and it's which is really, in a way, that's, I suppose, it really, I think you'd say it was the Atemwende, the breath turn that came with the Meridian speech, after which there was this definite break. But before that, he's in the speech grill, Sprachgriller poetry of the final volume of the new collection by Joris, of the earlier poetry, he's definitely moving into this territory where the death of the synonym or whatever. There was metaphor was just no longer the poem words, just there was this atomic aspect of poetry where, in a way, it couldn't be broken down. You couldn't reduce things into metaphor. And with Salon's later poetry, there's almost no choice. You cannot finesse it. You have to translate it exactly as it is in the German, and as closely as you can in the original. Almost, I mean, when I used to study Greek and Latin at Oxford or wherever, we had the Loeb editions, you know, which would basically, we're talking about literal translations. If you're translating Salon, I think one should attempt to be as literal as possible. In the later poetry, I think it's a sine qua non. In the earlier poetry, I think it's preferable too, but I can see how somebody could be tempted to write, to translate the earlier poetry in a way which is more poetic in an English sense, that when one's trying to push one's own poetic persona, when rather than just serving Salon himself.
It's interesting in light of all this to think of Salon as a translator himself. Of course, he translated from a number of languages. He translated Shakespeare, Apollinaire, Marianne Moore, Giuseppe Ungaretti. So just to give a sense of the range there, but what do we know about him as a translator? What was his criteria? What did he look for, and how did he handle other people's words?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned in the piece that he said that he only wanted to translate poetry that spoke to him. And of course, then there's this wonderful book, which I've also reviewed, Under the Dome by Jean Dev, where Salon chose to translate Jean Dev's first collection. And he wanted to translate it. And it was a reciprocal thing going on, because Jean Dev then also translated poems by Salon, and we had the benefit of having Salon sitting over his shoulder, saying that this is how it should be. And there's a point in the review where I used that in a way not as a stick to beat Joris with, but he has the advantage of getting a closer translation perhaps than Joris might have done with his French. It seems to me more authentically closer to what Salon wanted.
You in that in the book that you refer to there as well, which is an account of the friendship between Jean d'Eve and Celan when they were in Paris. You get some wonderful sounding details, just little glimpses of the poet in movement. You mention that d'Eve observed Celan tearing up paper with extraordinary violence. His waste basket always overflows with paper torn, but not crumpled into balls, as with others I know.
That's right. I mean, what you see there is this latent violence, but which wasn't always so latent, particularly when it came to inflicting injury on himself. So there was an attempted suicide in 1967, of course, tragically a successful one in 1970, but also a very violent attack on his long-suffering artist wife, Gisèle Lestrange. He nearly killed her too. I remember he had been so much of a hero for me, Celan, for so many years. I was very upset when I've known about this for a while, but I remember when I first discovered this, and I thought this wasn't the Celan that I wanted to celebrate, but it was who he was. And of course, then you get that reference, those observations from Jean d'Eve, who was so obviously in awe of Celan and very sympathetic towards him, but extremely observant. It's a marvelous book, actually. Under the Dome, I think it's a really terrific book and very, very moving. And he talks, I didn't mention it in the review, but he talks elsewhere about Celan's this powerful spiritual presence, that you felt you were in the presence of somebody with this incredible spirituality. And I always see Celan, I've always seen Celan myself as a prophet, you know, use the word, you know, vatic, from the Latin word vates, for a prophet. He has that kind of, to me, the great poets have a vatic quality, and Celan undoubtedly had that. And it's interesting then to see Jean d'Eve's observation that he had this spiritual presence, because that seems to relate so well to this idea of him being this vates, this prophet.
And for a poet who underwent such a transformation in the way that he wrote and the way that he conceived of words, there's a surprising circularity to his life, I suppose, relatively short life, as you said. So the story of his suicide, the book left open on his desk, a book of a biography of Hölderlin, which takes us back to the beginning, his earliest influences almost. It just gives this tremendous circular sense.
That's absolutely true. And as I mentioned in the review also, that this poetry having this existential dimension to it, in the sense that it really was the means by which he was able to survive. As you say, there's a circularity there going back to the sort of more surrealist poetry and that he related to of the school of André Breton and écriture automatique, you know, so automatic writing. I mean, in a way, where's the difference? He has come full circle. It's quite extraordinary. So it's, and that's a nice thing to have mentioned, that I hadn't really thought about that, but it's true. That the fact that it's Hölderlin that's really he goes to for his final words.
And you said there's a particular line, a sentence underscored, wasn't there, in that Hölderlin?
That's right. Yeah, this is it. Sometimes this genius goes dark and sinks down into the well of the heart. So that was the Hölderlin sentence that he underscored. And that was the last that we knew of him.
Well, it's hard to know what to say after that. It's such an intense story, both in terms of the life and the poetry itself, obviously. But it's been a pleasure to talk to you about it today, Mark Glanville. Thank you so much for your time.
My great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come on the show, fantasy dinner parties for frustrated lockdown bibliophiles, and Margaret Drabble takes us on a city walk in the company of H.G. Wells and G.K. Chesterton, among other urban ramblers.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Lenarduzzi and I'm with Lucy Dallas. This week's MB introduces an idea, a competition no less, to mitigate the lockdown blues. Have you seen this, Lucy?
I have seen it. It's not our competition, alas, is it?
It's not. It should be. We should have thought of it ourselves.
It's a good one. It's launched by the Book Collector, which is a website for book collectors and librarians and bibliophiles, it says. Well, do you want to explain their brilliant idea?
Well, it's fantasy banquets for bibliophiles. It says all comers are hereby challenged to concoct their own fantasy banquets for bibliophiles. You're asked to describe in 1,000 words an imaginary banquet for book lovers. Your characters can be alive, dead, or fictional from any period of any age, colour, or creed. It says no need to follow the rule of six, no need to bring your own bottle. Although I would find that the rule of six is actually quite a handy limiting factor, because otherwise...
It probably is, because otherwise you'd say, I'd like 200 people for dinner, please.
Exactly, and you wouldn't get to talk to any of them. The other thing that they don't specify, in fact, is whether the inventor, the host, would actually be attending themselves, because I don't think I would want to be there myself, to be honest. It sounds like a very extreme version of Never Meet Your Heroes. It could all go horribly wrong. They could be really mean.
I suppose so. It says, I had to look on the website. It says, imagine you've got Virginia Woolf chatting to Jermaine Greer, or Thomas Jefferson to Malcolm X. Maybe Peter Pan is sitting beside Evelyn Waugh. What would they eat and drink? Might they wish to dance afterwards? Which is a nice thought. Has Elizabeth Bennet remembered her dancing shoes?
Well, you see there, I wouldn't want to interrupt any of those people. I would just want to listen to them.
And what if they started? What if you had prepared a careful menu for Evelyn Waugh and Malcolm X and Jermaine Greer, and they all started moaning about the food or something? Anyway,
well,
go on, Thea, who would you
I'd
have?
Cry.
Can you think of two or three off the top of your head?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's the multi-channels debate. There's too much going on. I don't know where
to
start.
Because you can have writers or fictional characters.
Exactly.
I reckon I'd like, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I wonder whether they specify do you have to tell them what the food will be? Is that a stipulation?
No, you could. I think you just could do that if you wanted to.
Because I think I'd be better at that. Especially if we went back to previous episodes of the podcast, was it about a month ago we had Norma Clark on? We could probably plunder that for menu ideas. You could have Mrs. Ramsay's bœuf en dôme. You could serve it with James Joyce's hot floury potatoes wrapped in a white napkin from Dubliners. See, I could take care of that side, and I'd be very happy to delegate the invitees to you.
All right, cool.
And then I'll just hang back in the corner and listen to everyone.
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it? I would have one sort of ancient one.
Mm.
I don't know whether you would have Ovid, or you might have Odysseus.
You could have all of the Homers. You could have all of the people who go into being Homer.
Oh, no, they'd go on and on and on and on. Wouldn't they, all the Homers? That would be cool. You could have one Homer. I don't know. I'd have... depends.
One representative of Homer.
Maybe. Or maybe that's what I mean, because you can have... fictional characters. Maybe you could have Odysseus. I think he'd be the best one of that lot in terms of...
He's intolerable, though, isn't he?
But he was always telling stories. He was always singing for his supper, you know.
I'd probably invite Chaucer. I think he'd be a great one. Storytelling. Baldy.
Orlando would be good fun. Virginia Woolf's Orlando. And could change gender mid-course if they felt like it, and that would be cool. You could have Chaucer, couldn't you? Or the wife of Bath, she'd be good fun.
She'd be a right laugh.
Yeah. Maybe a bit much.
Well, people who want to take part in this, what do they need to do? I think they need to, all the entry details are on the website of the Book Collector, but there is £500 at stake. And because everyone's supposed to be submitting 1,000 words on it, that's quite a lot, actually. I wonder whether they'll publish them somehow, or the winner.
I don't know.
I'd quite like to read it.
So would I. But people can always, if they do enter, they can always tell us who their guests were. We'd be interested to know, wouldn't we?
That's true. And I'll ask NB to keep us posted, and then I can report back.
Yeah,
good idea. On the winning combination.
That would be a great idea. And after that great, enormous banquet, what you would need is to walk it off.
You would.
And so if I were to ask what brings together Big Toes, Knights Errant and the Invisible Man, you might be at a loss to answer, unless, that is, you just read Matthew Beaumont's new book, The Walker, on finding and losing yourself in the modern city. We're lucky enough to have Margaret Drabble writing about this for us in the TLS this week, and doubly lucky that she's joined us today. Margaret, many thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
To begin with, I think I have the impression that you're quite a walker yourself, are you?
I'm a very keen walker. I'm not a competitive walker, but I walk a lot, both in the city and the country.
Yeah, because you mentioned in your piece, in fact, your own wanderings around North Kensington and Grenfell Tower. Not a happy walk, but a significant, meaningful one.
We can see Grenfell Tower from our London house. We could see it burning. And to me, it was a very much a part of my life for months. I'm not there now. I'm in the country now. But the tower is my walking patch, and all those housing estates around the bottom of it, I know quite well. I managed to get lost, but I know them well.
And Matthew Beaumont's book, so this is very specifically, you say, between the country and the city, but so this book is very specifically about walking around the city, because you mentioned that he wrote another one about walking at night, didn't he? And it is, as you say, a very male-dominated subject.
Yes, and I think he neglects one or two of the women walkers he could have put in, but he does point out quite reasonably that women in the city didn't find it as easy to walk as men do. They're always suspect, they're always looked at as the wrong kind of woman. So it is very much a male occupation, walking at night in the city, or even during the day. It's more of a male diversion, I think.
Yes, and I think he does also mention at some point that there's also the homeless people. There's a very unromantic side of being out in the city at night, that, you know, the person walking around taking things in is in a position of privilege, as it were.
Absolutely. I mean, it's OK if you're Dickens and have got somewhere to go home to, but it's not very good if you're on the street.
Yeah. Would you say, is it in the tradition of the flaneur like Baudelaire and co, or is it a bit more modern like the psychogeographers and the situationists of the 60s who wandered and got lost on purpose?
There's quite a lot of psychogeography in it. I mean, he quotes Baudelaire a lot. And of course, as I'm devoted to Baudelaire, I'm always happy to come across Baudelaire. He quotes T.S. Eliot frequently, particularly that bit about crossing London Bridge, and he uses the word commuter, which I don't think was invented then, for the bank clerks going to work. So he invokes the sort of the city walker, but then there is a sort of shadow of homelessness, tramps, vagabonds, and in the Middle Ages, if you were walking around at night, you were illegal, so you were under a curfew. So all that is drawn in.
Mm-hmm. And so is his focus very much on how walking the city shaped the minds and the work of selected writers that he discusses?
Yes, it is. There's a lot about how imagery comes into one's mind. Also, some of these writers, as he makes quite clear, used to walk in order to think. I mean, Wordsworth in the country walked in order to think. But here we have G.K. Chesterton. and Dickens, walking the city streets in order to think, walking at night in order to think, and all that comes across very strongly. Their books are shaped by their walks, their characters are shaped by their walks.
And so Virginia Woolf is one of the rare female appearances in his work.
Yes, but I thought it was quite interesting that Mrs. Dalloway, about which he writes quite a lot, he doesn't really focus on Mrs. Dalloway at all, but on the chap back from the war, who is pursuing a woman through central London. She's wearing a smart hat, I think, and she never looks back at him, but it's a pursuit. And he calls him Pete the Ripper, and it's interesting that this was the very week that... that Peter Sutcliffe died, and there are so many resonances in this book, things that hook on to other things that are happening at the same time. And of course, Peter Sutcliffe terrorised the whole of Yorkshire, that people didn't dare go out.
Yes, and actually had a huge effect on women walking on their own, and also men walking on their own, because most of the men were horrified if they found themselves walking behind a woman and would have to try and cross the street, or, you know.
Yes. Yeah, they felt... they felt suspect simply by being there. No, yeah. it's very interesting, that aspect of danger and outlaw, of being an outlaw. But Virginia Woolf herself was a very bold walker. She was quite a brave person, and she didn't mind striding around on her own, day or evening.
She said to walk alone in London is the greatest rest. It was for her, it was a real escape, wasn't it?
Well, it is a wonderful treat, and I wish I could do it now, because although I love walking in the country, I do love walking in London. And one of the things I love doing is getting on a bus with my Freedom Pass and going to somewhere I don't know, and then just getting off and going for a walk. And of course, that now is no longer such a safe activity as it used to be. I was interested that Matthew Beaumont doesn't mention the Reclaim the Night movement. And he did write a previous book about night walking. And I wondered if he mentioned it there, but I couldn't get hold of a copy because there's no libraries anywhere. And I bought a sample and read the intro, but I don't think he mentions the Reclaim the Night movement there. And I remember having huge arguments with my niece about that, and about whether it was wise to go around in very short skirts in London.
But I mean, that was part of the point of Reclaim the Night, wasn't it? Was that you're allowed to walk, you know, we were allowed to walk around at night, that was okay.
That was exactly what she was arguing, and I was saying, but common sense tells you that there are some places where you're asking for trouble. She absolutely wouldn't see that. Though I think now she's a little older, she might see that I might have had a point that I was worried about.
Sure. In terms of resonances, you also say at the beginning that it opens with deserted cityscapes of Dechirico, and also the Ray Bradbury story, The Pedestrian, which is also about an eerily empty city.
That is a very powerful story, and it reminds me of many occasions in America, where I've been walking in New York or Los Angeles and realised I'm not meant to be walking at all. You're just not meant to walk. I know lots of stories of people who have been for a walk and been positively sort of arrested for walking along a sidewalk.
I'm laughing because it's true. I've had so many of those experiences where you're walking in LA and people just look at you like you're nuts.
Why aren't you in a car?
Yeah, what are you doing? Where are you going? It is... Well, that story is prophetic, because when he wrote it in the 1950s, it hadn't got as bad as it has now, when motor cars are the only means of transport in some parts. So there is no sidewalk.
And you say that Matthew Beaumont he's a big fan of modernism, but in fact he sheds a lot of light on some Victorian and Edwardian classics, such as The Invisible Man. What's his reading of that story?
Well, it's very interesting. He sees The Invisible Man, who, as we all know, because we've all know the story, was a scientist who invented a way of becoming invisible and then discovered it had great inconveniences, like you couldn't get any food and you couldn't fight. You had to wrap yourself up in clothes in order to be seen and therefore fed. And it's a very macabre story. And at the end, Beaumont points out that the invisible man becomes... from having been a very self-important, unpleasant character, becomes a sacrificial, Christ-like victim, naked and torn to pieces by the mob. like a sort of scapegoat figure. And I hadn't quite seen it in those grandiose terms. I've just seen it as a scary story. But it is, he's absolutely right. There's a wonderful bit where he compares the invisible man whose head is all bound up in bandages, and that his mouth, there is no mouth. And the landlady comes in and she just sees this huge space where his mouth is meant to be, and Beaumont compares that to Munch's the Scream, which I think is brilliant, this huge open black mouth screaming. It's full of perceptions like that which are really very enlightening.
Mm-hmm. And he's very good on etymology as well, isn't he? I like the excavation of the word errant.
He's very funny about words. I mean, I sometimes wonder whether he's having us on, because like Joyce, he just loves a pun or a play on words. But the thing about errant is just really, really interesting. I never knew that. It's a sort of slightly, misleading etymology. And the thing about haunting and home, I had no idea that the words haunting and home had any connection at all. They almost seem the reverse of each other, but they do have, according to him, an etymological root. So he's very interested. And the big toes, which you mentioned earlier, that section about big toes is very, very funny. All the kind of wordplay he manages to get out of our toes is excellent.
Well, that's what we wanted to ask you. What does he tell us about the importance of the big toe? Why is it so important?
Well, without it, we wouldn't be able to walk. I mean, he goes into the whole history of bipedalism and how the human being got up on its hind legs and walked. And what a huge difference this has made to humanity and culture and our way of living, which, of course, is all true. And he cites various scientific authorities on bipedalism and how we first climbed trees and the savannah and began to learn to walk on 2 feet. But the important thing is the big toe. And I mean, my big toes by now are completely horrible, so I didn't like to be made to think about them too much. They're really, truly hideous now. But he does say we must look at our big toes bravely and learn to confront them. And he's quite right. There's a very wonderful photograph of a big toe as well. I mean, he got all this from a philosophical surrealist treatise. But the stuff about toes is just very, very, it's delightful, it's crazy, and it's just extremely enjoyable.
I was going to say you mentioned surrealism there, but just talking about big toes, it very much made me think of that scene in L'Âge d'Or with by Buñuel and Dalí, where the woman is seen sucking the toe of the religious statue.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's exactly it. And it makes you long to go to an art gallery and look at the big toes of the saints, because he's very good on the big toes. And I know that in the Ashmolean, there's a wonderful painting. I always forget who it's by. It's by some minor but very important Italian artist called, it's of Saint Helena, who was the mother of Constantine, I think. And she's got the most magnificent sandals, and she must have some wonderful toes. So I'm looking forward very much to being able to get back to the Ashmolean one day and have a look at her toes.
We'll have 3,000 words on that, please, Margaret.
First thing to do after lockdown.
Well, I'd love to be able to go.
And when you say also that his yeah. fondness for puns, he's got this extraordinary one where he ends up, is this right that he ends the chapter talking about somebody calling for the dictatorship of the Tola Prairiat? Do you think the whole chapter is just for that pun?
I couldn't pronounce it even in my head. You did it beautifully. But that is based on his analysis of the first scene of Coriolanus, which I'd always been very interested in. It's where Menenius addresses the rabble of the citizens. And he calls the first citizens, he addresses him as the big toe of this assembly. And I always found that very funny. And so does Beaumont. So he's waiting for this very anti-capitalist joke to come up. Can you say it again? I can't pronounce it even in my head.
Tola Prairiat.
Tola Prairiat, that's right. Yes.
I think so, yeah.
I think that's right. I think that's right. No, he was working his way towards it magnificently.
And can you tell us as well that you talk about the idea of the industrial sublime, which is clearly something that you have been thinking about for quite a while.
I have. I have. I I wrote this book called A Writer's Britain, which was really to accompany the photographs of Jorge Lewinsky. And he got some wonderful photographs of clay pits and slate pits and cooling towers. And I found it very hard to get texts to go with some of them because there weren't so many texts as there were about the Lake District. And I thought this category must be the industrial sublime. But I think the phrase hadn't been coined then, it didn't really exist. So I don't think I used it. I kind of hinted towards it. Could I say also that I've just finished today reading, I don't know how to pronounce this either, but Shuggie Bain, shortlisted.
Oh, Shuggie Bain.
Shuggie Bain.
Yeah, the booker.
That has got some magnificent industrial sublime landscapes of Glasgow. I mean, I think the most powerful thing in that book, which is a very powerful book, are the industrial landscapes. They're really superb.
And so you found that it was a phrase that you kind of you needed at the time and later found, as it were. Is that, and it's a phrase
yes.
that you uses, is it?
Well, I don't know who first used it. I really don't know who first used it. And I thought it was me, but when I looked back at the original text of my book, it's not there, but it is there in the afterword of the reprint. But by then, it had been introduced by somebody else. And it's rather annoying not to be able to find out where it was first used. It is used quite frequently now in art history and in exhibitions and catalogues. But I don't know when it actually began. There's another word that that Beaumont invokes, which is edgelands, which is that sort of bit around the city, which is neither town nor country. And I think we do know exactly when that was coined, which was later than the period I'm talking about. And that was very, very attractive to the psycho geographers.
Yes.
And that was Marion Shawd, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
So and there, nice to have another woman in the very male book.
Another woman. And there were several poets who took up in a big way the Edgelands theme.
Oh, yes. Michael Simmons Roberts and Paul Farley, about 10 years ago, they had that lovely collection,
yes.
a shared collection of poems. I think it was, in fact, called Edgelands.
Yes, it was. Yes.
Yeah.
In a way, I wonder if the Edgeland isn't actually the place to be looking for today's Virginia Woolf's Virginia Woolf's or H.G. Wells's. I mean, not many writers, I suppose, these days can afford to live in central London. So I expect you might find them stalking Walthamstow marshes more than Bloomsbury these days.
I imagine that there are quite a lot of them walking there. Yes, through the eastern marches of London.
And finally, Margaret, we know what our first mission, as soon as we're out of lockdown, is to run towards the Ashmolean and look at the toes of the mother.
I can't wait.
So we look at St. Helena. But when we are allowed to roam as much as we please, where do you think your ideal walk would be?
You're looking for a city walk rather than a country walk, I think. Because that's what the book is about.
I guess I am, because that's the theme. But you could always disobey me and say whatever you want.
Well, there are parts of London I'm so fond of. I don't really like West London, where I now live, or when I'm there I do. But I've got to know it so well in a kind of sorrowful way that I do quite like walking under the Westway, under the motorway, through those housing estates. There are many walks around there that no one could call them beautiful, but they're full of human interest, of architectural oddities. So I think I will be happy to get back to walk through some of those familiar patches again.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like the industrial sublime to me as well, in some ways, is it?
It is, with those huge towers. But then crouching at the bottom of the towers, you will find little Victorian terraces that haven't been bombed. So much of that area was bombed. And so there were these huge towers like Grenfell, but there were little corners of Victoriana. And then there's the Westway, which in itself is the industrial sublime, but the Edgelands are underneath it.
So a bit of everything.
A bit of everything.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. And let's hope you are able to do that walk soon. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Margaret Drabble and Mark Glanville. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell. We'll be back next week. But for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.